All right.
Oh, not everybody's back yet. I'm being a strict taskmaster. Well, I guess people are attending to... That's all right. We'll... No. Don't. We'll wait. We'll wait. I don't want you to suffer for the next... and just think this will be permanently inscribed on the podcasts that are... I've received a few emails from people in other places, so there are people following the course elsewhere. So, hello to the what? Right, it's a right. It's a so hello to all of you in Canada. I gather there's a few people in Montreal or Toronto, I was told, who are listening. Welcome to the class. While we cool our heels for a short time here.
Hi.
Yeah, I was asked last year by the university if I was interested in a MOOG, or whatever they're called, MOOGs, right? Yeah. And I said I'd... MOOC. And I said I didn't... I said I didn't want to do it. I've ambivalent feelings about it. I mean, I do podcast lectures, and I do know that there are people who are able to engage this stuff that wouldn't be able to attend a class, obviously. My concern about MOOCs is that it's a move towards a really dire erosion of academic culture by creating one more way in which there will be celebrity superstar professors, and that the professoriate, if you will be reduced to glorified teaching assistants to a few, you know, stars who will then, and that the next phase of it will be the commercialization of it. So far these haven't been cash cows or money makers for universities. They're basically a way of asserting their prominence. But it seems to me, in the context of budget cutting and efforts to create, quote, efficiency, that MOOCs could very easily begin to displace the ordinary work that academics do. And so my feeling about this is, the reason I'm ambivalent is that there is obviously some positives to it, but I think that teaching is such a central part of the lifelong development of scholars, not just of the next generation, but of the people doing the teaching. Teaching is the best way to learn. And certainly this case for me, that my having taught this particular course as many times as I have is partially what keeps my mind preoccupied and working on these ideas over time. And it really does change the way your own thinking about things develops. So that if the role of the teacher becomes a more passive accompaniment to somebody else who's doing the core formulating and grappling with things, if that becomes the norm, I think it impoverishes the whole process. So even though it might be true that there are some lecturers who are more compelling, more exciting than others, I'd rather go to an exciting lecture than a less exciting one. All of us would. As a system level way of fostering the perpetual production of serious and interesting thinking, I think that's probably, you know, again, a degradation. But I've said no. But this is sort of MOOC light by having audio podcasts of. That's the MOOC.
It's a Pokemon character named MOOC.
I see. Well, it kind of fits my point about it being a... All right. What makes the capitalist state a capitalist state? This term that is using the adjective capitalist to modify the state This emerged in the late 60s and early 70s in a debate, it was formalized as a debate, between Ralph Miliband and Nikos Poulantzas. Nikos Poulantzas was a Greek-born French, I think he was a sociologist probably by training, maybe a philosopher, I'm not sure. He was a student of Louis Althusser, wrote in the 1960s and into the 70s. A very prominent scholar in the French face of this energetic renaissance of new ways of thinking in Marxism. Poulantzas and Terborn knew each other. Terborn studied in Paris for a while. Poulantzas, I think, was the most creative of a circle of people that were associated with Louis Althusser. Their particular theoretical positions were bound up with internal Communist Party, you know, disagreements and ideological fights. Poulantzas, as a Greek intellectual in the context of the Greek military coup in the 60s, was an exile. I don't know enough about his biography to know if he left Greece at that point or was already in France. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Ralph Miliband was a British Marxist, the father of the current shadow prime minister, Ed Miliband. There's recently been a big flap in Britain over the fact that Ed Miliband's father is Ralph Miliband, who is one of the most prominent post-World War II Marxist scholars. He was a sociologist in Britain. Some of the tabloids ran really kind of scandalously right-wing attacks on Ralph Miliband and by imputation on Ed. But Ralph Miliband was this great figure of being just a wonderfully warm and humane person who was a fantastic teacher and totally open-minded and encouraging of his conservative students. You know, he's a kind of model for a pluralistic, tolerant intellectual. And it turned out that there's a bunch of Tory MPs who had studied with him and felt deep affection for Ralph Miliband's ability to communicate controversial ideas in a way that they objected to the ideas, but not to his way of having this kind of open forum discussion of them. And so this whole debate has gone on just as we speak. I mean, this is the last couple of weeks there's been this big thing in Britain around this. Anyway, Ralph Miliband wrote a book called The State in Capitalist Society. Good book. Interesting intervention into these discussions. Nikos Poulantzas wrote a critique of the book, published in New Left Review, in which he drew the contrast between treating the state as a state in capitalist society rather than treating it as a capitalist state. That led to a reply by Miliband and another reply by Poulantzas. It was a good and productive debate. It was an example of a debate that actually, in some ways, it became more productive as other people picked up the discussion, because Poulantzas himself, being embedded in very much a ideological struggle framework in terms of how he engaged differing ideas, was less interested in really finding the points of similarity and identifying the theoretical differences and where and how they worked, and more in defeating an opponent in a battle. I mean, that was more his stance. So it wasn't that the debate itself, as it was framed in the New Left Review, was the most important part of it, although it did stimulate a very wide... So my particular relationship to this is a little autobiographical detour. So I was a graduate student when all these debates were occurring, and had read Poulantzas in French beforehand, and had written some things about Poulantzas with my good friend Luca Perone, an Italian graduate student in graduate school. And in fact, we wrote a long paper, which has only exists in Italian, he translated it, comparing Talcott Parsons and Nikos Poulantzas, sort of, on two different kinds of functionalism, sort of conservative and progressive functionalism. So I was involved in these kinds of discussions, and I wrote a paper with a couple of graduate students here, which is actually how I ended up getting recruited to Wisconsin. So I think I might have told you this story a little bit, with part of this capitalist state collective. I wrote a paper with Roger Freeland and Esping Anderson called Modes of Class Struggle in the Capitalist State, where we discussed this debate between Poulantzas and Miliband. In our discussion, we labeled Miliband a sophisticated instrumentalist theorist of the state, and Poulantzas a structuralist theorist of the state. So we drew this contrast between their two perspectives using the language of instrumentalist versus structuralist. We also made probably the rhetorical mistake of saying that Bill Domhoff, who's an American sociologist, works on power elites and the like, we called him the vulgar instrumentalist and Miliband the sophisticated instrumentalist. The term vulgar was a popular term in ideological fights on the left in the 60s and 70s. It basically meant simple-minded, you know, overly simple, one-dimensional, unsophisticated. And it wasn't, first of all, it wasn't fair to Domhoff, because there's many ways in which he's very sophisticated. It's just that on this particular dimension, he had a really stripped-down view of the state itself. He, I later discovered, took enormous offense at the fact that we published papers where we described him as the vulgar instrumentalist. He's about 10 years older than I am, 12 years. So he was a young, established, probably an associate professor at that point, published a huge amount on this stuff on power in America. And he was really pissed off at us. And I found out later that, and he was still angry. You know, like 20 years later, he's still angry. of course, it was a mistake. We shouldn't have, I wouldn't do it that way now. I feel much more concerned when I write of really being respectful for positions that I disagree and never using adjectives that have the character of ridicule. So I would never say it was a simple-minded. I might say it's an overly simplified view. That's a kind of softer way, an overly simplified view, or it's a stripped-down view and it lacks a certain kind of needed complexity. But when you use terms that have the character of making fun of somebody you're criticizing, it infuses in it a polemical and emotional content, which in the end I think doesn't serve any positive purpose. And it just triggers then anger so that people can't hear what you're saying. Okay, that's a little homily on writing. So here's the deal. State in capitalist society versus a capitalist state. What we called, and I think it's still reasonable to call, instrumentalist approaches see the state as basically institutionally neutral, but manipulated by powerful actors, particularly powerful actors whose power comes from their class position. The state is a state in a capitalist society implies that the political task is to seize this apparatus and wield it for other purposes. So if the state is a neutral instrument, its basic institutional properties make it wieldable by whoever it is that controls it. The task is to control it. That's the state in a capitalist society. Structuralist approaches see the very form of the state as embodying class principles. The state is a distinctive kind of state. of the many kinds of states that could exist in the world, the states that exist in capitalist societies have a distinctive set of features which justify calling them capitalist states, not just states in capitalist society. And therefore, they cannot just be seized. The political task is that they must be transformed in order to be used. The very form of the state generates consequences which are beneficial to capitalism. So you cannot simply seize the state, you must transform the state, and if you're in the kind of most rhetorically heated or polemically heated expression, you have to smash the state, you know, smash the state and build a new one. It can't just be transformed in the sense of you have to modify this bit and that bit. Got to sweep it away. Now, that rhetoric, smash the state, makes some, there are historical contexts where it makes some sense. So if you're thinking about the czarist state in revolutionary Russia, and you ask, can the Bolsheviks as a would-be socialist revolutionary party simply take the machinery of the czarist state and use it for emancipatory purposes? One would say, well, of course not. I mean, you can't have a bureaucracy that's run by hereditary aristocrats where the principle of promotion has to do with personal connection and bloodline. That's a feature of the state, that's how it works. You can't just take that and say, okay, now what you have to do is serve the people. No, you got to get rid of the administration that's structured around feudal principles. Those principles make it impossible to be used for social emancipatory purposes. So the kind of French Revolution and the Russian Revolution's idea that you have to sweep aside the old order and build a different kind of state, that did seem to make sense when thinking about the abolition of the encrusted, moribund, feudal absolutist states of the early modern period. The question is, does that also apply to the bourgeois state, the capitalist state, the state in which all sorts of democratic forms and Weberian bureaucratic forms are present? Is that unwieldable for democratic egalitarian purposes? Well, the structuralist said the analogy still holds, that this is a state machinery designed for the purposes of reproducing capitalism. It will generate capitalist reproducing effects regardless of who's running it, because it's built into the very structure. And therefore, if you want social emancipation, you got to transform those institutions. You can't just use them. That's what's in play in the issue of, is this a capitalist state? Yeah.
In terms of the revolution, they create new structures, but sometimes they used the same people, right? They hired people from secret police from the Tsar's time.
Right.
So the question is, what these people kind of functional for this job, or this is these kind of common features of repressive state in Tsar's time and in Soviet time?
So the general point about the people versus the structure, if you're a strict structuralist, there's no problem with using the same people, because it's not persons that matter, it's the structure of positions that matter. It's the structure and nature of the institutions and how they're organized. That separation of persons and positions, which as strict structuralists would argue for, I think ignores the fact that persons themselves are embody various kinds of structures, cultural structures, for example, and that the dispositions which actors have that have been forged under one historical situation may disable them from being able to function well in an alternative structure. Now, in the case of Tsarist Russia's secret police and the Bolshevik secret police, it may be that, in fact, since in practice, the Bolsheviks were not creating a socialist state. They were creating a form of authoritarian statism. They were creating a new kind of state-centered command over the society, the machinery for commanding the society. Well, it's possible that the kind of formation of dispositions and obedience to authority and subordination rituals, I mean, all of those properties embodied in the persons of the Tsarist regime made them very suitable for this new regime, precisely because the new regime wasn't an emancipatory regime. It was serving other purposes. But, you know, that for other, in other contexts, it may be that the actual persons are disabled from functioning well in an alternative structure, which means that you have to have different people as well as a different structure. Or, alternatively, people may be more flexible than that model suggests. What the model I just gave you is essentially Pierre Bourdieu's model. Pierre Bourdieu's model is very much that by the time you're an adult, your dispositions are set. With very rare exceptions, people are not reprogrammable, so to speak. So Pierre Bourdieu, if you want a kind of little handle for thinking about this, you all know the story from My Fair Lady, or Pygmalion is the original George Bernard Shaw play, and then the musical is My Fair Lady, where a flower girl, a Cockney flower girl from Covent Garden, gets Eliza Doolittle, gets retrained to be an elegant, sophisticated, cultured lady. And it's a debate between two guys who are linguists. Henry Higgins says you can do this. His friend says it's impossible. So his friend is a Bourdieusian who feels that by the time you're an adult, your dispositions are set, your cultural capital is set, and you've got this firm habitus, and you just can't change. It'll come out. And Henry Higgins says, no, this is all trainable, and he teaches Eliza Doolittle to speak like a lady, and his view is once you learn how to speak like a duck, you'll act like a duck. So in the My Fair Lady, there's the song about the rain in Spain falls gently on the plain, and which she says the rain in Spain falls gently on the plain, and Henry Higgins said, the rain in Spain, and finally she gets it. Okay, well, that's the story. Well, I think people are way more flexible than Bourdieu does, and that the structure in which people live, once they figure it out and it has time to operate, many, I don't know, all, most, I don't know what the distribution of flexibility is, but a very large proportion of people in the world are adaptable under altered conditions if they can figure out the altered conditions and those conditions are stable enough for time to take place. And that, so this issue of persons and positions has this looser coupling, not rigid coupling. That's a theme we're going to actually engage in. I think it's another one of these really interesting things. In Terborne's view about ideological change, where he sort of falls between a kind of Bourdieusian and a more flexibilist view. Forecasting something in about 2 weeks, I suppose we'll be talking about that. Okay, so you've got this instrumentalist and structuralist position. There's a central question for which both instrumentalists and structuralist positions propose answers. Both approaches make a similar observation. Broadly speaking, the policies and actions of the state in capitalist societies generally contribute to the reproduction of capitalism in one way or another. So there may be, from time to time, policies which are disruptive of capitalism. These are rare, and even more importantly, they almost always get reversed. The question is, why is this the case? How do we explain the fact that the state broadly functions? This is the descriptive observation. How do we explain this descriptive fact that the state broadly functions to serve the interests of the capitalist class and reproduce capitalism? How do we explain that? Instrumentalists say the state fulfills these functions by being controlled by capitalists or their direct agents. The state acts at the behest of capital. So capital as the kind of generic expression to include both capitalists and their agents tells the state what to do, and it does it. It acts at the behest of capital. The structuralist answer is the ruling class is often too divided and too myopic or too stupid to guarantee its own interests. The basic mechanism through which capitalism is sustained by the state must be institutionally embodied in the very organization of the state. You cannot rely on capitalists to know what's in their own interests. In general, therefore, the state doesn't act at the behest of capital, it acts on behalf of capital. And to do so, it must have what Poulantzas called relative autonomy. If the state had no autonomy, if it was in the pockets of capital, it would act in ways that would be damaging to capital. So that was the debate. It was pretty, you know, nicely framed. And it opened up a research program, some very, really interesting research. There was a fantastic dissertation that never, you know, another one of these wonderful dissertations that didn't get published as a book. It was being completed just as I arrived, and it was about the colonial state in what was then Rhodesia. I guess that northern Rhodesia became Zambia or Zimbabwe? Zambia, I think. I think Zambia. And for the first 50 years of the colony, the colonial state was simply an office in the largest land company in the colony. So the colonial state was directly run by colonial capitalists, had zero autonomy from the local capitalist class. That was the colonial state. And I forget, I can get you the woman who wrote the dissertation's name. It's slipping my aging brain. But what she discovered was that state was completely incapable of solving conflict that were emerging as white settlers came to Rhodesia, created their own capitalist businesses, were engaged in all sorts of conflicts, both with the indigenous population and amongst themselves. You know, there's lots of conflict resolution that was needed. And it was absolutely impossible for the completely non-autonomous state to play the role of providing cohesion to the dominant class and resolving their petty conflicts in terms of a long-term project. And the land company petitioned the British Crown to set up an autonomous state after 50 years. And only after that happened did the accumulation process stabilize in Rhodesia. So it's a fantastic study because it finds a nice case where you have a completely non-autonomous state and you can see what the problems are for stabilizing the base. You know, it's a nice functional base superstructure problem. And why relative autonomy, taking the state out of the hands, direct hands of capitalists, was necessary. Okay, so what we're going to be exploring in this lecture, and as it will spill over until Tuesdays for sure, what we're going to explore is exactly what this structuralist argument means. What does it mean really to make the claim that the very form of the state has a class character? There are two main themes that we'll be studying. The first is the methodological problem. What exactly does this claim mean and how do you establish it as a research, as a claim about the world? You know, what's the kind of evidence? How would you study the class character of an institution? And the second theme will be what exactly are the institutional properties that render a state distinctively capitalist? The first of these themes, the more methodological one, I will draw mostly on Klaus Offa's work on the nature of the idea of the limits of possibility and how the state creates limits. I'll explain that in a moment. And the second one, I'll draw primarily on Joran Terborn's What Does the Ruling Class Do When It Rules? Okay, let's tackle the methodological problem. Let's see if we can get through this part, which we might be able to, and then we will do the Terborn part of the discussion as the first part of Tuesday's lecture. So Offie explores two issues. What do we mean precisely when we say the state has a class character, and how do we empirically demonstrate the specific properties that we claim to be have a class character? So the first has to do with the meaning of the idea. What's the claim? The state has a class character. The core idea that Offie introduces is the notion of negative selectivity. Negative selectivity. That's what it means. That's what class character means. Negative selectivity. The structure of the state is such that it makes certain state actions impossibles and others improbable. It systematically imposes biases into the process of policy formation. And this is the key substantive point, these biases have a class content. They're not just random biases. They're not just biases that are generated by the peculiar worldviews of the actors in the state. They are systematic biases which have a class content. Negative selection means that policies that are inimical to capitalism will have a much tougher time ever being discussed, let alone being passed. Policies which are favorable to capitalism will have much easier sailing. Proposals and actions that are favorable will have a much easier time and a much higher chance of getting passed. And this is not because of external control, but rather because the biases are built into the procedures. They're features of the very procedures by which policies get formed that are going to make it tougher for anti-capitalist policies to get through the process and easier for pro-capitalist ones. The key idea of negative selection then is grounded in another expression that he uses as a way of clarifying it, negative filter mechanisms, negative filters. Think of, I think at some point in the article he uses the idea of sieves. You know, if you're panning for, well, I don't know if gold miners do this or not, but you know what a sieve is. It's a wire mesh. And you can have a wire mesh with big holes and little holes, right? So a way in which you might want to get rid of stuff would be to have a series of sieves, ever more fine. If you want to end up with very fine sand, one way to do it is to have first a coarse grain sieve that removes all the big rocks, and then a moderately grained sieve that removes the little rocks, and then a fine grain sieve that in which everything goes through except pebbles. And then at the very bottom, you have a sieve that just lets the water through. So you end up with very super fine sand in the bottom sieve because it's gone through these different levels. Each level can be thought of as excluding things. You're filtering out things so that you're only left with what you want. And in the sieve metaphor, what you want is super fine sand. So if you had a great scoop out of a beach that's filled with all sorts of stuff, and what you want is really fine-grained sand to use in making Tibetan mandalas, you know, where you have the sand drain go through your fingers. Well, you need a way of getting rid of all the stuff you don't want, excluding them from the table, the final sand that you use. Well, that's the metaphor that Offie is using for understanding what the state does and what the mechanisms that we have to look for, how they exclude things, keep them off the table. And he proposes four sieves, four negative filter mechanisms. They're not always entirely clear and exactly why they're ordered in this way. You know, Offie didn't return to this theme to tighten up his argument. So a good way for theory to develop is for somebody to write a paper as good as this paper, you know, Offie's paper on negative selection, and then to listen to the criticisms, to have a bunch of rounds of discussions, and then to revisit it and refine it. Well, Offie didn't do it. Well, mostly theorists tend not to come back to the same point. So I don't find his four, I find them interesting, but I'm not convinced this is precisely the way to think about it, and certainly the nested sequence didn't quite work for me. Still, the ideas, I think, are clear enough. The first, he identifies as sort of structural or constitutional properties of the state. These are the ones that Terborn is going to emphasize when he gets down to the business of actually laying out the organizational properties of the state that do have a class character. This would include things like the way the state embodies the public-private distinction. Right, so that's a good one. The state legally embodies a distinction between what's public and what's private, and that excludes certain things from state consideration. You know, if you've well established that boundary, that's a constitutional property of states, and that boundary helps to exclude stuff. Or electoral institutions, the way in which you organize elections makes certain kinds of political conflicts easier to get into the representational space and other kinds harder. The difference between various kinds of proportional representation systems and winner-take-all systems has big implications for the kinds of party organizations that are going to be robust and the kinds that won't be. So the first filter mechanism was the structural institutional features. The second refers to as ideological filters. We'll be talking about those, of course, in the next block of the course. The third has to do with procedural matters. This, I think, one might think of as the administrative bureaucratic processes by which rules actually get implemented, which has to do with the way bargaining is organized inside the state, the way the state turns policies into actual, or laws into actual policies. And finally, repression as a filter mechanism. Repression as a way of excluding things, yeah.
So these are organized like hierarchically?
So that's the part that I have to say, that was his metaphor. He wants these to be thought of as a sequence. That doesn't quite work for me. They're operating simultaneously. It's not quite clear which are the broad sieves and which are the fine-grained sieves. So that part of his argument to me wasn't as crisply formulated. Yeah.
So these are mechanisms that enable the state to exclude things rather than mechanisms that make the state exclude things, right? They're like the ways that it excludes rather than what makes it exclude.
I don't think that distinction is being made. These are the features of states which embody a class bias. Now, the question of how did it come to pass that they had these features? Now, how do we explain the boundary between public and private, which is built into constitutions, which excludes certain anti-capitalist things, makes it very tough to get certain kinds of anti-capitalist discussions going because of the public-private divide built into the constitutional order of states. He's making a claim that that is a feature of the state that does the excluding. The question of how does it come to pass that states have it, he doesn't discuss. The answer to that question is, I think, probably, that there were historical moments where those issues were up for grabs, where people were deciding what should or should not be in a constitution, and in which part of the purposes of actors were to ensure the security of private property by excluding things from the constitutional order. So that class feature gets, by design, built in intentionally. It stays in because it actually serves these functions stably. Yeah.
So are these four things sort of like the mechanisms by which the state acts in a stabilizing form for capitalism then? Would they be like the direct, like the arrows that you had on the other
piece? So these are the, these are like the fishing rituals.
Okay.
That is, these are the features of the state that produce the consequences that are beneficial. Right, so these are like the fishing rituals. The public-private distinction is a structural property of the state. Ideological filters are a little vaguer, exactly what he's talking about. These procedural issues are clear enough. You know, if you're going to have a certain kind of due process with a certain kind of, you know, 97 steps you have to go through to raise an objection to a policy, then all of these bureaucratic policies make it much easier for organizations and interests that can hire lawyers to get their interests into the process than it is for social movements. So if you want to, I mean, just think of it this way, if you want to create an institution that's going to in generally favor the inputs of elites and disfavor the inputs of the masses, you want a set of procedures that require a lot of sophistication and require intermediaries that are expensive. And then you can say it's open to everybody. But if it's open to everybody, as long as you're very sophisticated and can afford intermediaries that are expensive, that kind of administrative rulemaking system is going to favor the interests of elites and help to stabilize an elite-centered capitalist order. That would be an example of a procedural aspect that excludes and has a class bias. So some of this corresponds to, I think, what a lot of people just intuit, the fact that if the state wants to seize your property for eminent domain for a project, because the project will be beneficial to, you know, economic development, let's say, and you're a wealthy capitalist, wealth or manager or professional, and you can hire lawyers to challenge it in court and to mobilize evidence that actually you could build this highway that will be good for economic development through that other part of town because, after all, the property values are so much lower there, you're more able to defend your interests through that set of procedures than if you're poor. And that's built into the very structure of the state. That is, the procedures by which you can get your interests fairly represented in a process is biased. So those biases have a class character. They favor wealth and capitalist interests. And they have a class bias that helps to stabilize the social system too. Those are the claims, and then these are the kinds of mechanisms that Offey sees does it. Now, the key problem, then, methodological problem that Offey points out is what you're really explaining when you invoke these biases. Whenever you invoke a notion of bias, you're explaining things that don't happen. So you observe things that do happen, but making a claim about things that don't happen. And some things that don't happen could happen, they just haven't happened. You're trying to make an argument that they systematically don't happen. And sometimes people are just wrong. They think that something is systematically excluded and it turns out to just not have happened yet. I mean, an example of that, I don't know if I mentioned this when I was talking about the formation of this class and the class analysis program when I first arrived. The graduate students were really eager to start a Marxist-oriented program in the sociology department. They thought this was going to be a horrendous battle because they had read Offey and thought that it was the bourgeois university systematically was biased against a coherent, radical sub-program around Marxist and emancipatory themes. They thought it would take a real mobilization and they would have to have petitions and, you know, I don't know, sitting in the chair's office or whatever. It turned out that I with the students, we wrote a proposal for the class analysis program, and it was instantly approved, no problem whatsoever. It hadn't been systematically excluded, it just hadn't happened yet. So that's the problem. Non-events, we observe events, we theorize that the things that don't happen have been excluded, and sometimes they've been excluded for what can be called contingent reasons. This is under the, I think, point three, the methodological problem. Some non-events are just potential events that haven't yet happened. And if an event, in order to happen, requires a social movement, and the social movement hasn't happened yet because people haven't done it, and there isn't any exclusion of the social movement, you know, so it could be that there still is an exclusionary process if there's something blocking the social movement. Some non-events become events once people decide they want it. Some non-events are what Offie calls epically excluded. They don't happen because there is no social category that could conceivably support them. So it's not that they're excluded by some kind of subtle bias mechanism in the institutions. It's just that there's no interest that would ever back the thing in question. Why do we not have animal sacrifices by the state at harvest time? You know, why on the steps of the state capitol do we not have a ceremonial slaughter of goats and chickens and, you know, as public displays of reverence? Well, you could say as much as you want that this non-event we observe never happens. That this non-event is because of all sorts of biases against animism or whatever. But a more reasonable thing is that this doesn't happen because there is no social constituency. We're just in a different historical epoch. It's not in play as a potential thing to happen. That's just being blocked. And it's not interesting. It's not an interesting question. I mean, anybody who would want to do deep research into why we don't have animal sacrifices on the steps of the state capitol would have a tough time, I think, publishing the results, because nobody would be interested in it. It's very unlikely that there's a deep explanation for why that's excluded, is my judgment. Now, that could be wrong, of course. One could imagine that, and then some hotshot social theorist and sociologist would come up and show that actually it's pretty interesting why we don't sacrifice animals on the state capitals in the United States or in the world today. So he's interested in looking at the cases where it's not just contingent, it hasn't happened yet, and it's not just epically off the historical agenda. Things that really there are good reason to believe they could happen, they would serve interests, they would be beneficial, but they don't happen. These are systematically excluded events. And then he addresses the question, why is it so hard to nail this down? And he goes through a series of possible strategies for identifying the systematically excluded. That's our task, to identify systematically excluded. And he shows the limitations of each of those strategies. We're out of time, so I can't go through those strategies today. We will begin. I'll begin with point four on these strategies for identifying systematically excluded. Then I'll discuss the Terborn argument on Tuesday, and try to condense the state and accumulation argument into a shorter piece. I think in some ways, you know, that's a gigantic topic, and because it's such a huge topic, in a way, I can strip that down to more limited elements. What I don't want to cut short is the discussion of the state and democracy and its contradictions, which is what we'll do next Thursday. All right, see you on Tuesday.